Thank you all for coming this morning. I'm so glad to be here. This was a really wonderful invitation, and so generous of you all to come and spend an hour or so talking sheep. Well, maybe a few other things too, but anyway. I am married, as Cindy said, to a sheep and cattle rancher, and when I first moved there, he said, "Would you like to come spend the summer at a ranch?" I thought it was the greatest line I've ever heard. And I said, "Sure, why not?" Because lamb happens to be my favorite food. And when we got married, all I could see was a lifetime of lamb chops. It was heaven. So I'd like to thank all of you, though, for letting me join you. Last night was an extraordinary experience. From the minute I arrived here, a little dazed, but I think it's a plot to keep us all isolated, the airline schedules and in frequency. But from the minute I arrived here, I started talking to some of you, and I heard the most wonderful stories about why you're here, what your hopes and dreams are, what you'd love to do in a perfect world, and how we're all going to save the land and the West and manage to live on ranches, or at least live the kind of life we think we want to live. Those dreams are so important, and they're a part of what's kept the West for so long. And I maintain that that's part of our marketing strategy, that we keep the West the way we want it. So although I'm going to end the talk with a history sort of the trailing of the sheep, I'm going to start a little bit before that and sort of look at marketing in general and how we deal with it. And the most important thing, and I realized again, I always believe this, but if you take nothing with you from this talk, take the message that we have to tell our stories. That is the most important thing we can do. I happen to write, I don't expect everybody to write, but we all have so many stories. I started hearing them last night, and I wished I could have written them all down right then. We live a very unusual life. Most people in this country have no idea what we do on a daily basis, and would have no idea that a sandhill crane, for example, nested in the middle of our grain fields and was there all summer with their thrilling calls and their beautiful sight of them when they fly. These little things make our life extraordinary, and we need to tell these stories because, in fact, that's our marketing plan. And I want you to remember that as we go through this. And once again, after last night, I was struck with the thought that I wonder sometimes why I'm up here and why it's not you, because any one of you could be up here talking, I think. But we will go on, and I will start perhaps a little bit differently than I had planned to. And before I begin, I do want to thank Cindy and Terry and Don, who have been so extraordinarily kind and generous with their time and preparations for getting me here. Thank you so much. It was really wonderful to work with you. I'm going to start, which I wasn't going to do before, but I'm going to start with my story. And along the way, I'm going to read to you. This is a book called Bitterbrush Country, which comes in part out of the essays that I did on public radio for over 18 years about living on the land and ranch life. And I'll tell you how I got there. But I had not planned to move to the West when I took a 3-month job in Helena, Montana. It was just going to be a short interlude. But it was there that I met one of its board members, a man by the name of John Peavy, who was a state senator and a third-generation sheep and cattle rancher in Idaho. And he proposed, as I said, that I might spend a summer at his ranch, which I thought was really a wonderful line. But I did decide it couldn't do too much damage. One summer, what did that, you know, what could I lose? Well, that was almost 30 years ago. And it's been an amazing ride since then. When I moved to the ranch, I knew almost nothing about ranch life. I have a father who is a writer, wrote about the West, wrote about American Indians. So we had traveled the West, but I'd never lived in a remote place where if I forgot a quart of milk, I was in real trouble, and where people had to drive an hour every day just to pick up the mail. This was a huge new experience, and it was basically a man's world. When we start branding or rounding up the animals, doing various things, and I had questions, I was really reluctant to ask them because I knew that people thought of me as an outsider to begin with. Who is this woman from Washington, D.C.? I had spent most of my life in urban America, mostly on the East Coast. And so I did know that I did know what I didn't know, I guess. And I knew, but I was afraid to find out. And fortunately, my husband said, getting in the pickup, we're going to drive around, I'm going to show it all to you. And for several years, this was our life. And I learned to carry work clothes in the car because I always had a flat tire, especially when I was dressed up going to some kind of luncheon or meeting. I learned that to change a flat tire, you've got to remember lefty loosey, righty tighty. Do you all know that one? Invaluable information. I got so good at changing tires that once when I got a flat tire outside of Mountain Home, the town of Mountain Home, people would pass me and wave, "You're doing a great job!" No help. So anyway, so I became very good at that. I also learned that there was no service. No one wanted to come all the way out to the ranch when something broke. And of course, we have no cell phone service. I also learned the nomadic life of sheep ranching in particular, but all ranching in general, and the flexibility to handle any number of immediate crises, from bulls that got caught in cattle guards, to the one favorite bull I had who came into my yard when no one was around, got in through a very small gate, and stood in all my flowers staring at me on the other side of the window. I was talking to someone, a friend from Washington. I said, "I have to go. Something's happening here." And in fact, it was those kind of events that started me writing. I realized how far I was from Washington, from my friends, from the life that I had a certain comfort level in, and I wanted to get it all down because I knew that no one would believe me when I tried to tell them. I did go to work for a farm organization during the Depression years of the 1980s. It was a very painful experience for those of you who remember those years. I watched families fall apart, ranches abandoned, alcoholism and suicides turn our lives into absolute nightmares. Pain and fear filled the countryside. About that time, I realized that it was not only neighbors and friends, but it was our ranch that was in trouble too, and I went home. And this was almost 10 years into my time here. I decided that if I was truly honest with myself, I was never going to become Cowgirl of the Year. I was never going to rope ride and castrate everything in sight. So, but perhaps I could write about the people that did. And I decided I would write these stories, I would try and capture them so I wouldn't forget them. I had no idea that I would do anything with them. I just wanted to remember this life, which became newly precious to me when I realized how much we were in jeopardy and how much we stood to lose from all of this. That was, almost 20 years ago now. And I still like to write. I still believe in the value of stories. And I, as I said in the beginning, not everyone wants to write, but those stories have brought more people into my life and allowed me to share our lives with more people. One of the things I wanted to do was read a little bit from this book, and I'll take a I'll stop right now and just read a little piece of the introduction, which will tell you how I started writing. I took the first few stories into the local public radio station, and they liked them, and so that started the 18-year arrangement with them, which was just great. But I began to write in memory of friends who left the land, losing their balance in life. All of us struggled against huge economic odds and a marketplace run by multinational corporations that fixed prices far below the cost of production. Then came stories prompted by a new fear, as environmentalists, of which I am one, and cattlemen, of which I am one, shouted at each other over the very things they shared in common, a love of the land. The strident voices were frightening, neighbors and friends at war with each other. Radical environmentalists made newspaper headlines demanding that we be thrown off grazing lands we'd used for decades and depended upon for survival. As a lifelong environmentalist, I was stunned. As a rancher, I was terrified. Between extremes, I planted myself in the center, looking for solutions to save both the land and its people. In the midst of this acrimony, we could not hear the chatter of developers who stood on the sidelines, fueling our anger while they watched. As John and I traveled the back roads and small towns of the West, we found stories in a landscape marked by broken dreams, abandoned cabins, and ghost towns, visible memories of the hard work and determination of people who tried but could not sustain themselves in this landscape. There were communities like Pahrump, Nevada, Grasmere, Idaho, the Mojave, Amargosa, and Harquahala Valleys in Arizona and Nevada. And of these towns, the ones that survived had turned into recreational developments, a clutter of trailer parks, motels, condominiums, scattered across hillsides in a blaze of irrigated green lawns glued down over brown desert grasses. The traditional keepers of the land are cleared away, bought out, and the landscape turns from quiet introspection to carnivalesque cacophony. And I'm afraid we are losing our direction in the confusion and our souls in the reckless grab for the future. Today, those of us on the land are battered by farm policies that urge us to get big or get out. And we know that the family farm cannot keep up with corporate farming monopolies. But we cannot give up trying either. When we least expect it, the markets soar, making our crops and livestock valuable again. We breathe a sigh and allow ourselves to think about a new pickup or putting a new floor in the cabin kitchen. These are erratic moves of weather or drought and early frost, and they humble us again. It is a dizzying ride over which we have little control, but we're determined to survive because at its heart, ours is the most primitive struggle for home, for place, and for belonging. So that's how I started writing. That's what I wanted to write about. I will say now, we'll kind of turn a little bit from this to what's going on. And I think in a sense that I was a marketer from the beginning. I mean, to me, I wanted to tell people these stories and help bring them into our life. This is something I really learned from my husband, too. He is the first to open the ranch, to invite people over, to take them on a cattle drive, to give them personal. We now give people personal tours, we call it, limited to 8 people. And we do 2 or 3 a summer, and we just, they're one day only, no sheets, no bedding, no overnight issues that we have to get into. We meet people in town in the morning, drive them out to the ranch. My husband talks about all of our operation. He talks about how we move the sheep, where we keep the cattle in various seasons. He shows them wildlife migratory trails, all kinds of things that go into our ranch operation. And then at the end of the day, they come and have a barbecue dinner. And we take them finally up to the gravesite of the original owner of our ranch, which is way up on a hill across from our cabin. And it's a great story because he was a Scot who came to Idaho to herd sheep, took his wages in sheep rather than in money, amassed enough to start a sheep ranch, wrote all the old boys in Scotland and said, come on over. They did, brought their families, homesteaded, and the operation, the ranch grew and grew. Many of the people who came over couldn't make it, so James Laidlaw, this original rancher, bought them out, and what now remains is quite a large area, of one part of which our family bought in 1960 from one of Jim Laidlaw's sons. But these stories are our land, and they're part of what makes our place so special, and people love them. And when Jim Laidlaw died, he and a friend made a bet the first one that died would bring a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label to the funeral. So we take people up to the gravesite. We pass around a bottle of scotch. We give the old man a drink, and then we leave knowing that there's still at least part of a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label in the grave. But all of this is so rich with meaning and history and what we are about. About the same time that I was started writing and realized that we were in trouble at the ranch, there was a new movement of what I call radical environmentalists, which I think set the environmental movement back years. I don't know if in this part of the country you know of the Western Watersheds group, and a man named John Marvel. But his goal was basically to get ranchers off public lands, which would cripple many of the operations and put many thousands of ranchers out of business. He happens to live in the town on the other side of the ridgeline from where we are, so this became a little personal. I want to say one thing about our ranch, which I neglected to say at the beginning. It's in south central Idaho. It's along the Little Wood River. It's a very rural area. The closest town to us is Cary, which is a very small population of about 300 people. However, if you follow the road from Cary around, you ultimately end up about 45 minutes later in Sun Valley, which is completely different. It's light years away. It's a whole other world. It's a place that's second home to many wealthy people. It's a place of constant entertainment, of coffee houses, of restaurants, of boutique shops. It's hard to imagine, and it's an oasis within Idaho. In 50 miles, people there know nothing about what's happening in Idaho, 50 miles in any direction outside of Sun Valley. So it sets up, from the very beginning, a sort of strange sort of contrast in lifestyles. And quite frankly, I just assumed settle into our ranch and never leave, but we do close the ranch in the winter, and we do move over to the southern part of this area of the resort community. The efforts of John Marvel struck fear into the hearts of ranchers throughout the West, or at least in our region, because he was succeeding in court cases, and he was getting to various political leaders, not many of them, but some. And this really was no ordinary sort of duel between rancher and environmentalist, but rather a huge press expose that he enjoyed employing to vilify ranchers throughout the West. His motto at that time, the motto around the area, was cattle free by 93, which really kind of paralyzed ranchers every time we heard it. It was to get ranchers off the public lands. This also encouraged me to write, because I began to find environmental friends who did not know enough about what we did on the land were lining up with John Marvel, and I knew that if they understood what was at stake, that this would not happen. So that was another impetus for me to start writing. But it was also took us into a bigger arena, and I want to sort of open my world into your world at this point, because I think that there are three areas where we've seen such dramatic changes since the days that I've been discussing. And the first is we've actually begun to become marketers, I believe, by telling our stories. And the first area is we've been marketing our caring and the importance of the land to us. And that was something that was missing in the equation. I think we were being portrayed by people like John Marvel as abusers, as people who had just used the land and didn't care what condition it was in. I mean, that begs the issue that we have to use the land ourselves, and if we trash it, there's not going to be anything for us to use either. But people weren't making that connect. And I think about that time, a whole new movement started in sort of collaborative care of the land. And there were many projects around the West where range managers and environmentalists and ranchers and even economic development specialists, county commissioners, started coming to the table and talking about sensitive lands in their area and how best to deal with them. Not only were ranchers at the table, but at that time a really important thing happened. People looked at ranchers and went, "You actually are not abusing the land. You have been the people that have been the keepers of open space. And if it hadn't been for your ranch, this whole part of our community would be developed now." And I think that was a major step in sort of turning on the light for many people who are not in the ranching community, that ranchers really mattered. I also saw this as a second part of this. I'm going to stop for a minute and read you a story, because I did write a story about it. Does anybody here know about the Malpai Borderlands Group in New Mexico? This was Did I see a hand? No. Yes. Okay. They were sort of one of the first out there to start this collaborative process and try and reach, pull the community together. And I think this story, my husband and I went down and spent a couple of days there. And I think this says a lot about that process and why it was so important. I think specifically because there was so much acrimony at the time in the West. But it also gives you a picture of a ranch that's on the border with Mexico, and it has a certain romance about it, I think. The Gray Ranch of Animas, New Mexico, occupies over 326,000 acres of open grass valleys, interrupted here and there by mountains and low hills. It stretches south to Mexico and west to the Peloncillo Mountains at the Arizona border. It is rough country, but beautiful in its primitive rock and low brush landscape. My husband and I stayed a night at the Gray Ranch. In a half-day drive with its manager the next morning, we covered only a portion of the sprawling ranch land, but we came away with a strong sense of its history shaped by border activity with Mexico. Names filled in the details: Pancho Villa, General Pershing, Outlaw and Smuggler Mountains, Chinaman Hills. We drove up the historic San Luis Pass, which straddles the Continental Divide. Its hillsides were covered with Cholla cactus, a sign the area had been used hard in the past, rustling cattle back and forth across the Mexican border. In the morning stillness, the stories might have seemed like folklore if it weren't for an occasional glint of sunlight thrown off passing vehicles along Mexico Highway 2 at the end of the valley. The Gray Ranch has a long and rich history, but its current story may be the most interesting. In 1990, it was purchased by the Nature Conservancy to preserve its undisturbed space and unique indigenous grasslands. Soon after, local ranchers learned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was interested in the ranch as a recreation area that might attract as many as 65,000 people a year. This brought the community people together, who feared their fate might resemble the ravages of Tucson and the sprawling development of much of southern Arizona. They formed the Malpai Borderland Group to protect the land and its ecosystem and to maintain their livelihood as ranchers. They began to talk to people they thought were adversaries, the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and environmentalists, only to discover they shared the same goals for this region. A rancher, a member of the group, decided to buy the Gray Ranch with family funds and set up a foundation. They were neighbors. Wendy and Warner Glenn said in the first newsletter to the group, they had worked together to get telephone, school bus service, and rural electricity. Now it was time to tackle their biggest challenge, saving the land. The Gray Ranch became their showpiece and staging area. They initiated two programs. The first encouraged the return of healthy grasses through controlled fire. This replaced years of fire suppression policies that allowed scrub brush to take over the landscape. Second, they began grass banking to provide grazing lands for ranchers who needed to rest their own dry or overused pastures. In exchange, a rancher paid a grazing fee and turned over a conservation easement to the Malpai Group, securing the area from developers. But what I like best about this story is neighbors working as community to save their lands, when as individuals they might not have been able to do so. And they're defending their livelihood without the acrimony that had defined so much of the Western debate. The Malpai Borderland members say they are the radical center. I like that idea. As others line up on the extremes, I feel at home with the ideas of these families, and the center seems a little less lonely today because of them. So it was turning out that these sort of collaborative efforts were really working, and they were proving that, or they were demonstrating that ranchers are sensitive to the land, care about the land, that it's not only their livelihood, but it's their life, and that they are generations committed to place. Something got added on to this process, and I don't know if this happened in your communities, but in our valley, which is booming with the development and second home building and multi-million dollar homes, the county got together and decided at the turn of the century that they, right after that, that they were going to do a 2025 report to sort of outline what their vision of the Valley in 25 years. And I think probably this has happened in other communities around not only Idaho, but around the West. The upshot of that was really interesting because they came up with a term. It was not peculiar to them, but they incorporated it in this plan for 2025 to protect working landscapes. And it was one of the early uses of that term, but it was so exciting because it was us. I mean, the people who lived on the lands were, in fact, providing working landscapes. And they were encouraging people to live on the land, to work the land, provide for themselves and for their community, and hold on to that, again, to that open space. So those two things were extremely significant, and I think they were essentially things that we marketed without really realizing we were doing that. The next area that was particularly important and seemed to emerge after that was the idea of food. And I think in food we have definitely been marketing ourselves. It all started with the 2003 mad cow scare over Christmas. And we were all paralyzed with fear because we didn't know what this meant for our industry. But ultimately, we began to realize that people were caring about their food in new and different ways, and they wanted to know where it came from, how it was grown, and what went into what they were eating. I think this was a huge boon for ranchers, and I think that we've been able to work with that, whether it's farmers markets or any kind of ways of standing up, because a lot of this, quite frankly, is due to the takeover of agriculture by corporations, and we as family farmers were fighting that as much as consumers are fighting it. We've lost our packing plants and our sale yards in local communities. We have no real contact with what happens to the food we produce after it leaves our ranches, and that's been a real setback, I think, for us. So the ability to perhaps hold back some of the meat we raise and sell it locally, or in the case of sheep, and I want to go into this just really briefly, but the sheep industry was, I think, the hardest hit of any industry, and in the 1990s, over 40% of sheep ranchers went out of business in this country. So those of us who remain are, you know, sort of stalwarts, I guess. I'm not quite sure what we are, but crazy, probably. But I don't know if I should read another. I have another story I want to read instead of this one. But 2001 was a particularly brutal year. And it started in May with prices up around 92 cents a pound. And by the end of June, within 1 month, they were at 48 cents a pound. It was crippling. Nobody would even offer to buy our sheep. I mean, we had to beg people to take them. People were advising to stay back, hold back. It was bound to change. It never did. And at that time, the story I wrote was based on a story out of Texas that Safeway had made an announcement it was going to be bringing in New Zealand lamb. And so it was a protest to that. And this was right after 9/11. If any time we should have been supporting our own industries and our own people, that was it. The Texas Commissioner of Agriculture protested, and in fact in Texas they reversed that decision, but that was the only state I know of that did that. So this was a particularly terrifying time for us, but what it led to was unique, and it is, again, a marketing tool and something that I think the sheep industry should be very proud of, and that we should all look to this as sort of a model. And I might add, this movement was led by Wyoming Boys, and in fact, it's a Wyoming cooperative. It's called the Mountain States Lamb Cooperative. I don't know how many of you know about it, but it was started by Brad Bonner, Frank Moore, and Pat O'Toole, among others, local heroes as far as I'm concerned. We had tried in the industry various ways of saving ourselves, but this one, they borrowed and raised, borrowed and did whatever, begged, to raise $10 million to start a producer-owned cooperative for their lambs. That means us. We all own this cooperative. They recruited 125 families from 10 western states, and bought 50% interest in Rosen and Son, which was a lamb and veal processing company and distribution center in the Bronx, New York. We went back there. It's a fascinating place to see. It's 60 years old. It's at the top of the industry. And this cooperative bought 50% of that operation, and we worked as partners. In 2008, the Mountain States Lamb Cooperative was so successful that it bought the remaining 50% of Rosen. The co-op members are now owners of a meat company and have direct input into how their lamb is marketed. The co-op works with producers on an individual basis and pays them on a grid that rewards lambs of optimum weight and yield grade, so that we have a product that is lean, tender, and flavorful. You can tell I've got the marketing down. But and we are able to tackle the competition, which is New Zealand and Australia. Its members participate in the profits at a new level that has turned the industry around. We're getting more for our lambs now than ever, than the whole history of three generations of producing lamb. They market lamb that's free from hormones and antibiotics. They package the meat in easy to prepare lamb sausage, meatballs, ribs, legs, whatever. They pursue every potential market, from the kosher market to the halal market to, you know, Safeway. And by doing so, they've dramatically increased lamb sales. And people know they're eating the best lamb because it's American lamb, Western American lamb. So I think we've been marketing our connection to the land. We've been marketing our connection to food. I'm going to try and sneak in one more story, which I should have read at the beginning of the discussion about the co-op. But I want to read this because it's my husband's favorite, as you can imagine when you hear it. And it shows how marketing begins at home. Let me just see for a second. I didn't write the page number down. Hang on. This piece has an unfortunate title. There, because the book came out in 2001, a week before 9/11. And this piece is called Terrorism Tamed. And I couldn't read it because nobody could hear the word terrorism without panicking, rightfully so. But now it seems like terrorism are everywhere, so I can use this story again. But this is what we do on the home level. This is how we tell our stories, in a sense. The chilling term terrorism has become a part of every American's vocabulary, but I was startled to find its hand upon my life in the person of my husband. There is no kinder term for his behavior. His cause is lamb, and as a tireless advocate for this product, he makes industry promotion men look plain lazy. I first noticed his quirky campaign at restaurants. Dining out with him became embarrassing, and I was soon left to wonder why any of our friends wanted to spend an evening with us. We were seated at a table. He scanned the menu. No lamb. The waiter arrived. "I'll have the lamb chops, please." My husband perversely placed his order. The young man looked stricken. "We have no lamb," he explained, which was my husband's cue. "I thought this was a quality restaurant. No lamb? I can't believe it," he announced to the waiter, loud enough to be heard at all the tables around us. "Tell the manager that we're disappointed and we'll think twice before coming here again." The rest of us looked at the possibility of crawling under the table. Scenario two, lamb was on the menu. "Where's your lamb from?" my husband politely asked the waitress. Invariably, she had to check with the chef, and woe to the news, the lamb was imported. "New Zealand," my husband bellowed, so that once again, everyone in the restaurant could appreciate the event. "How could you? I thought this was a quality restaurant. Tell the manager." Occasionally, he ordered the meat without asking the country of origin, and when the tiny imported chops appeared on his dinner plate, He began, "You call this lamb?" he roared again for all to hear. "These are little chops, mostly bone. This must be frozen lamb from New Zealand. It's a slap in the face of the local producers. I could be eating Idaho mountain-fed lamb." And furthermore, he moved in for the kill. "New Zealand chops are just like chicken. You need sauce to give them any flavor at all. Tell your manager I thought this was a quality restaurant," and on and on and on. So you see, there are ways to get at this. It goes on to talk about what goes on in the grocery store, which is even more embarrassing, as he rearranges all the displays and has the lamb chops spilling over the beef and the pork. It's a real takeover. I just wait for the day when I'm going to be called to get Balaam out of jail for display tampering or something. But anyway. Okay. So these are some of the areas we work and we market our lives. The third and most important area, which is why I was invited here today and I'm going to get there, is the marketing of our cultural heritage. And this is something that I think of all the things I've talked about is the most important to me. And as I travel in other countries, it's one of the first things I look at, how people live, how they're connected to land and place, particularly in rural parts of foreign countries. We have started a festival. It's a 3-day festival held the second week in October in the Ketchum Sun Valley area. We thought we'd go right into the dragon's mouth, essentially, and just go there. But it was not a capricious kind of thought, because in fact, in the late, I guess, 19-teens, you know, after World War I, that area was second to Sydney, Australia, as a sheep center. So there's been a long, rich history in our valley of sheep ranching. It started in a very peculiar way, and this is, I guess, how a lot of things start. First of all, let me say that I might not have thought to do this if it hadn't been for some groundwork that was laid by others. I don't know if anyone's been to Washington in the summer during the Smithsonian Folklife Fair. It's truly amazing. Week of music and dance and food and people practicing their crafts and their arts and their way of life, making shoes, building things, cabinetry, whatever, on the Capitol Mall, and it's very exciting. I had always been impressed by that when I lived there. I never missed it. So I had that in the back of my mind. I also had, in recent years, been going down to the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada. And if you haven't been there, I really urge you to go. It is the best party of the winter, for one thing. But the people who come and read poetry and sing songs and tell their stories are so amazingly rich. And it started in the most humble way, just inviting local ranchers in. The first year, 100 people showed up. Now they have 8,000 people that come for almost a week. It is really a celebration of cowboy culture. Buckaroos and ranching families form the backbone of the weekend. They are the ones that tell the stories. And now people come from all around the country because they want to experience our lives, even for just a few days in the middle of the winter. All of this was sort of in the back of my mind when, in fact, we had a very unique experience in our valley. The rec district called us and called several other ranching families and asked if they could put a bike path on our livestock trail, which goes through the valley. And we move our sheep every year. We move through this very extensively overdeveloped valley up into the mountains for the summer, and then in October we return, bring them back to the desert country. But they always go through this area, and we always use back roads and kind of tried to stay out of the traffic so we wouldn't interfere. But the livestock trail goes the entire length of this valley. So when they called and said we'd like to put a bike path in, we said, no problem. They contacted all the sheep families. Nobody had a problem. Well, the asphalt dried, and the first band of sheep went up the trail, and the phone calls started. Your sheep droppings are getting caught in my rollerblades and my bike wheels, and you've got to get them out of there. And we're going, wait a minute, I don't think you understand the situation here. But the calls came, and they came, and in huge numbers. So my husband, again, the same one that invites people over to our ranch, decided a really good idea would be to put an ad in the paper and invite people to come out and help us move the sheep through the valley. They could sort of walk along the bike path and keep the sheep off the bike path. So we said, meet us at a local cafe at 6 a.m. People came. He told about the history of sheep ranching in our valley. He told the story of his family, of Jim Laidlaw's family. He talked about the nomadic life of sheep ranching. People were fascinated. They put on their caps and mittens, and we all went out and moved the sheep through the valley. People loved it. Kids came, classes of kids came out. Others came with their parents after they got out of school. The numbers swelled from 20 the first year to, you know, close to 100. It was getting to be a huge event. So the Chamber of Commerce jumped in, never went to miss a trick, but we love them. They did a great job. And they said, let's have a meeting in April and talk about next October. I think we can do something big. Well, of course, I immediately thought of Elko and the Cowboy Poetry Gathering and the Smithsonian. And when we met, I proposed a folklife fair on Saturday that would bring in all the groups who were so instrumental in making the sheep industry a success in our state. First the Scots, second the Basque, and now the Peruvians, who are our herders. Most all of our Peruvian, all our herders are Peruvian. So that was became sort of the backbone of the event. We had the Catholic Church had a huge Basque dinner that they had run for 50 years. They moved it to the festival. We had music and dance all day long. We had vendors. We had people, someone shearing sheep, somebody herding a sheep with dogs. A trainer was out there explaining the hand gestures and the whistles and whatever. It was amazing. For a while, we even had Basque games, but we were afraid somebody was going to have a heart attack and die. So we decided to cancel that. But it became really an exciting event. And it even expanded to include the Polish Highlanders from Chicago, which I resisted when they first called. I said, you know, this is about Western sheep ranching. And they said, I know, but we were all sheep ranch, we were all herders in the old country, in the Tatra Mountains, and we want to save our culture. So I said, okay, come on. And they came with their home brew in their pocket, and they, everybody loved them, and people were even threatening not to come back if we didn't bring the Polish guys. So anyway, so the Polish Highlanders are great, and we love them. This is the second weekend in October. If we had no festival, let me finish with the festival. At night, we did the most important part. We told stories. We gather in a theater, and some people lead stories, old-timers that we know, and we talk to them about their stories, and then we open it up to the public, and, you know, people are there. They tell about the, you know, the winner of 48 and the, you know, the whatever of 32, and it's just, they're amazing, and we record all these stories because, as far as I'm concerned, as you can tell, I'm a story person. That is the legacy of the Trailing of the Sheep, are the stories that we will have, at, you know, should we have to stop this event for any reason. This is our 14th year, so we don't anticipate stopping soon. But we, too, like the Elko Poetry Gathering, started small, maybe 800 to 1,000 people the first year, mostly local. And now we have close to 10,000 people that come to the valley every October. This is amazing because usually stores almost close in that month. There's usually no one there. It's done a huge amount for the valley that depends on the tourist income, tourist trade to survive. Our friends who own restaurants and small shops, and they need something like this, and it's provided a huge boost in our community. This is the same community, I would like to say also, remind you also, where John Marvel lives. So this is an even added sort of plus that all this is receiving so much popularity and people love it. And we even spotted him once getting a Basque lamb dinner at the fair. So that was good. Although every time he's asked by the press, he will say something like, well, it seems to be okay, but we have to be vigilant with these ranchers. We've got to watch them. Anyway, we start the weekend about a week or so early, and we go. My husband and I go into the schools with our border collie, and we talk about what it means to be in sheep ranching, because so many of the kids in the valley don't know this agricultural part of it. They see the sheep go through the valley, and they don't really even know why. So that's a great part of the program. Then there's the Folklife Fair on Saturday, and Saturday night the storytelling. But the big event is Sunday, when we bring 1,500 sheep through downtown Ketchum. They close the roads, obviously. Close the roads, and people stand along the side, and all the dancers and musicians come, the Basque Ankari dancers, the Scottish bagpipers with, 20 bagpipes and 15 drummers. It's just, it's so powerful. They lead the sheep into town. And we invite people to go behind the sheep and help herd them to the resting spot, which is about 2 miles away. Some do, some just enjoy the parade. But it's an amazing scene to see sheep in front of all these glitzy boutiques and restaurants. They really have the day, and people cheer and applaud. And it really is moving if you're in the business. It's really something to see. And I went to a wool growers meeting once. A friend of ours was being honored. We always go to the meetings, but a friend was being honored, and he completely broke down when he went to accept his award. He said, "I've been raising sheep all these years, but 2 weeks ago I stood on Main Street and watched, 10,000 people cheering for our way of life, cheering our sheep." And he was just, I couldn't have asked him to say anything better than that. It was just really a moving experience. But it's what we have to offer. We have sheepdog trials throughout the weekend. The restaurants serve lamb, American lamb, so that people get to try special dishes. It's really proved to be a remarkable thing that the Jack Lane Mercantile, which was the headquarters for all the sheepmen in Ketchum when it was a sheep center, is now a Starbucks. So that is sort of the headquarters for our event. Starbucks is really nice, and let us take a quarter of the building and recreate this little Lane Merc kind of experience. And people, two old-timers, one my husband, I call him old-timer, and another, talk about the history of the valley just before the parade. And then after the parade, we have a big lamb barbecue. We also take people up to the aspen groves north of town, about 5 miles north of town, where you can see the sheep herder carvings on aspen trees, which is becoming actually a very fine art form around the West. People are going around and documenting these carvings on trees, which sometimes are drawings. Our favorite is one of a naked lady, and then the next tree is a church. So we're trying to figure out if somebody was trying to hedge their bets, as they were carving. But you'll see these names carved in from 80, 100 years ago. It's really remarkable. And aspen trees are fairly fragile. They'll fall down. The bark will peel. So these need to be recorded while they can. And it's really a treat for people to just wander around in the mountain woods and see these things. And that's sort of the end of the weekend. But it's really a remarkable event because in this glitzy sort of resort, fast-paced area, everything slows down, and people come from all around to sort of sense what it means to be in the West, to be calm, to be out in the woods, to see these carvings, to see sheep, to listen to the music of cultures who have come here and made this place their home. It's a really amazing experience. A couple of years ago, I went to a conference very similar to this in Cedar City. It was a Utah Ag Diversity Conference, and they had called specifically and asked if I would come because Cedar City was expanding, experiencing such growth that they were building a Home Depot and a Walmart over the sheep trail. And they had put in a tunnel underneath this and the nearby interstate that was probably a mile long that they would you know, were supposed to take the sheep that way to their trails up in the mountains. It was the most frightening thing I've ever been through. I started to walk through it, and I was terrified. I can't imagine getting a band of sheep through something like this, concrete walled, not very wide. They lead them with a bale of straw, of hay or something, but I don't know how good that is for the ones in the back. And there's a point where you get to in this tunnel where you can't see the front and you can't see behind. And that's when I turned around and went back. Anyway, they were fascinated by the trailing of the sheep. And they started one the following year. They call it a livestock festival. And it's a little bit different. They incorporate a lot of sort of local, you know, old cars and other things in it. We don't let anything in ours that isn't sheep-related. But it's still going. And they're doing a great job, and it helped them enormously. And what it does is it makes people stop and look at our life and think, oh, it's not just a bunch of sheep, move them over there. It's our history. It's our landscape. And that's especially important where we are, where people are new to the area, so that all of this is a strange experience. But they need to be reminded where they moved to and what's happening. And ours is not a reenactment. We would be moving those sheep whether we had a festival or not. And that's sort of one of the really key things about the trailing that makes it so important. So I offer some of these ideas, from marketing our connection to the land and food to looking at what your community has, your strengths, things that you love that may be under assault, that may be the cause of skepticism or even conflict in your community. And we still get a lot of letters to the editor about people who go up in the mountains and run into a band of sheep, and they panic, and they see the guard dogs with the sheep, and they don't know what to do. And I'll leave you with this little thought. The Forest Service decided they would put a sign at the trailhead of some of these trails so that they would warn hikers, because there's so many of these new people who have moved in or come even for the weekend are there to hike and bike and golf and fish, whatever. But the Forest Service was getting a lot of complaints about the sheep up in the mountains, so they were going to put a sort of a cautionary sign at the beginning of the trail. And I said, whoa, 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 why don't we put a different kind of sign there? Why don't we say, welcome to historic sheep country? If you're lucky, when you're hiking, you'll see some sheep, guard dogs, a herder, and his camp. We hope your hiking with sheep will be a part of the adventure. You know, I just think we have to remind people it's not something to be afraid of, that our life is filled with extraordinary moments and extraordinary history, and we need to hold on to that history and hold on to what we care about so deeply. I am going to conclude right now with a short film, I hope. I think we've got it, is that right? It's in 2001, CBS Sunday Morning came out to record The Trailing of the Sheep. They wanted some kind of programming that would sort of be an antidote to all the terror that people were feeling. And they wanted to go back to communities and get a sense of the richness of our life in America. This was right after 9/11. So they came out and recorded this, and it's a little scratchy in the beginning. It's only about 5 minutes, maybe six. But it's a wonderful summary of The Trailing of the Sheep, and I'll be happy to talk to you more about that or any other crazy idea you think you have. I mean, we thought this was a bit crazy, but you know what? It's been the best thing for all parts of our community. So, thanks.
The town our Bill Geist first discovered a few autumns back.
Every fall in Ketchum, Idaho, the first snow signals the seasonal changing of the guard, as thousands of sheep hoof it south, yielding the slopes of the Sawtooth Mountains to herds of human skiers heading north. Ask any sheep herder.
The sheep come up in the spring and go back in the fall. Never changes, year after year.
Push them, push them, push them.
The sheep are happy to head to warmer climes. They go by the thousands, and they don't go quietly. Ketchum and the neighboring town of Haley hold an annual Trailing of the Sheep Festival featuring Basque dancers, Peruvian performers. And Scottish bagpipers. It seems an odd mix, but these three ethnic groups have accounted for most of the sheep herders in these parts for the past century and a half.
A lot of the Scots came over as herders and ended up taking their pay instead of in cash, but in sheep. And many of the Basques came over from the Basque country of northern Spain or southern France.
It was a job that they didn't need to speak English in. You know, they're out there by themselves, so they taught the dogs to speak Basque.
Sheep ranchers John and Diane Peavy came up with the idea for the big festival. Just a generation ago, there were still more sheep than people in Idaho. This town of Ketchum here was the hub of a burgeoning sheep industry, and this building, Lane Mercantile, was where all the ranchers came to discuss everything from weather to prices. Ketchum is now a trendy resort town with more art galleries than sheep ranchers. And Lane Mercantile?
This community is growing rapidly, and people are moving here from all over the United States. They would wake up one morning and see sheep out in their yard or going up the street, and they're wondering, what is this? This wasn't in the real estate agreement.
Yeah, 2,000 sheep.
2,000 sheep in my yard. So it was a matter of reaching out and saying, come on out and find out about the place you've moved to.
The Peavys kind of hope the festival promotes understanding among new arrivals who won't mind quite so much finding sheep in their flower beds and having to share the bike path with a few sheep.
I can just walk around all over and she'll bring those sheep behind me.
The festival features demonstrations of sheep herding by amazingly talented dogs. And sheep shearing. And displays of old sheep herders' wagons.
The sheep herders used to live in these?
Yep, they still do.
I think this is about 1960 up on, pretty close to 1960.
They're tours of the hills where history is etched in the bark of aspen trees by shepherds.
It reminds me an awful lot of the old hieroglyphics and the Indian writings that they did on the caves.
There are stories shared.
My father used to say that he felt the closest to God on a hill with a herd of sheep.
Of the drought of 34 and the blizzard of 48.
The snow was two and a half feet deep, and there was no way you could drive a sheep through that.
And of days at the Basque boarding house.
She fed Ernest Hemingway and Gary Cooper and Bing Crosby.
Where shepherds mingled with celebrities coming to the Sun Valley Resort.
A frying pan with a handle gone and no pot to cook maize.
And musicians play top 40 sheep tunes.
He sent me up a damned old dog. He said her name was Nell. The first time I set her on the sheep, she scattered them all to hell.
All in preparation for the arrival of the stars of the show, the sheep. Metro traffic reports a snarl on Highway 75 north of Ketchum this morning with heavy, slow-moving volume in both northbound and southbound lanes, leaving behind slick highway.
Right-hand lane. Thank you. Appreciate your cooperation.
Not to mention half-hour backups at the river crossing. Once in town, they do obey the speed limit, but run the lights. They're sheep. One does it, they all do. A color guard leads them right down Main Street in this full-blown sheep parade. This wall of wool, almost frightening in its proportions, surges into town, met not by fear, but by a minister.
I bless you. And now, with God's blessing and filled with God's love, you go. And be the best sheep you can be.
So blessed, they then pass by the assembled throngs, here to pay tribute to sheep, each in his own way. Not to worry, these sheep will never be entrees. These are all ewes, heading south to southern Idaho and on to sunny California. to dine all winter on alfalfa al fresco, and to give birth to lambs and perhaps some wool sweaters. Worn by the skiers, the sheep will replace when they return to the slopes in spring. As always,